Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service to the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on story time when we come back. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. This surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity from bank deposits to medical visits has produced greater efficiency and security. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. The federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American, according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, our state and local governments use computers to keep their own files on us. Now, a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state, New York, and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing some 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And every one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, this information about you is gained from 63 sources, and this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, your bank, your insurance company, and the industries around us obtain all of this information about us and from us? And what are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? And what do they want it for anyway? Well, knowing how this information is gathered and what information is being stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, then call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it, and let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and just as private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. And best of all, it's free, and you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Just send us an email. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine. Send us your email request. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about story time. You know, stories are very valuable tools in the education process. I like to tell my students stories of real people in real time who have already traveled down that road, already been there and done that. People who have already had the experience and can tell you how to do it without you personally having to invent or reinvent the wheel. One of those stories is called The Story of the Deacon of St. James, a fellow by the name of John Mallory. He ended up being a tobacconist. The tobacconist, this is back about 1754. John Mallory is the head deacon at St. James Cathedral in London. Now, the Church of England, you know, is the equivalent of the Catholic Church in Rome. Well, in Anglican or Anglo-Saxon times, the Church of England was the official religion of Great Britain, still is, as far as I know, and Queen Elizabeth, I think, is the head of the church, and then they've got this hierarchy here. You know, they've got a guy over there, he's kind of like the Pope, and then they have fathers, and they have nuns, and they got... You know, I guess they kind of broke away from the Catholic Church, but I don't think they broke away far enough, fast enough, or got as far away as they could get. But anyway, that's another story for another day. Well, this John Mallory now, he's the head deacon. Now, he's been here in the church for 30 years. And he's doing all those things that deacons do in the church, and we're not picking a religious fight here, you know. It could be any church, anywhere, anytime, but... This guy has dedicated his life to the church. And by the way, this guy is now 50 years old. 50. He's been serving the church since he was 20, since he was a young man. He's dedicated his life to the church. He works for the church full time. That's all he does. You know, he cuts the grass, he washes the windows, he collects the money. If there's anything that needs doing in here, he does it. And of course, then they've rewarded him with an office, with a title. And as the years went by, he's not just a deacon anymore. He's now the head deacon. Pretty prestigious job, you know, if you're a religious guy. So this is going on for a few years. And one day, there was a change in the policy of the church. They had a policy change. And for whatever reason, somebody on high decided that deacons should be illiterate. Now, John Mallory is illiterate. He can't read and write, which isn't all that important, you know, for a guy that's emptying the wastebaskets and washing the windows and cutting the grass and, you know, those kind of things. It isn't really critical, I suppose, that he know how to read and write and know how to do his ABCs or do his arithmetic or his numbers, but... For some reason, somebody on high decided that was a requirement, and so they passed down this policy decision and said all deacons now in the Church of England have to be able to read and write pretty early on, 1754. And so they passed that down the line, and old John, now he's really bummed out. He's concerned because he's illiterate. Never thought it was a problem. Dedicated his life to the church. Been there for 30 years. You'd think that they'd pass this policy, you know, and put it on to the next generation. You know, this old guy's about ready to retire, you know. And I don't know if that retirement at age 65 or not, but, you know, 50 years old back in those days is kind of old. And people died, you know, before they got to be 65. And so didn't have as long a lifespan. So in any event, this is a real blow to him. And so... They gave him 6 months to learn how to read and write. So he had 6 months to work on the problem. So he's studying diligently and doing everything he can to learn how to read and write. But, you know, 6 months goes and 6 months comes and goes, and he can't read and write. And so he gets terminated. I mean, they just canned him. So he came home, and he's really despondent, and he's talking to his wife, and he just doesn't know what he's going to do. Now, he and his wife, over the years, had saved about 1 year's worth of his pay. Now, he's been there for 30 years, so he saved about 1/30th of his pay. He's got enough money to see them through for about 1 year. And then, from that point on, he hasn't got a clue. I mean, this guy's not a blacksmith. He's not a carpenter. He's not a shipwright. He doesn't have any trades, any skills, any abilities. This guy's been working in the church. This guy passes out songbooks. This guy collects the money on Sunday. This guy washes the windows, empties the waste paper baskets. This guy is a religious guy. This guy is dedicating his life to the church. This is what he knows. This is what he's done. There wasn't any need for this guy to learn how to read and write, but, you know, policy is policy. You know, it's kind of like the Frontier Airlines people, you know, policy is policy. That's the way government works, you know. Policy is policy. It doesn't have to make any sense. It doesn't have to have any reason to it, any logic or any common sense involved in it. Some guy on high says this is the way life is going to be. So his wife says to him, well, now listen, John, you've always wanted to be a tobacconist. You've always liked tobacco, and you've always talked about how you thought that you could be a good tobacconist, that you could mix the various tobaccos into the various blends. You know, today when you buy a Camel cigarette, you know it's already blended. But in the old days, you know, tobacconists blended those tobaccos. You know, tobacco that came from North Carolina was something different than that that came from Georgia, which was something different than that that came from Jamaica, which was... And when these tobaccos came in, you know, they had different flavors and different aromas and, you know, different characteristics. And so a tobacconist was a guy, like a butcher, who was a specialist. He blended tobaccos like the butcher, you know, cuts the meat into various cuts. So he'd thought about that, and so he took their life savings now, and he went out and he bought inventory. He rented a little hole in the wall on Piccadilly Circus, little hole in the wall tobacconist shop, and so there he was. He set it up, and surprisingly, it went very well. At the end of the year, he had actually made a profit, and he had supported his wife, and didn't have any children now, just him and his wife. And you know, he was poor as a church mouse there working for the church, but now for the first time in their lives, they actually had a little money. And he actually took a little of that money and he opened a second tobacco store. And so the second year, he had two tobacco stores. And so at the end of the third year, he had three tobacco stores. And the fourth year, four tobacco stores. And five, six, seven, eight, nine. Pretty soon, this guy's got 14 tobacco stores. He's been in the business now 14 years. He's getting older now. He's about 64, 65 years old. He's a real old man now, by those standards. Got 14 tobacco stores. But that's not the end of the story, as old Paul Harvey would say. This guy got a letter one day from the Bank of England. And, of course, old John, he couldn't read. So he took it over to a friend, and he said, "Would you read this letter to me?" And the guy read the letter, and it was an official letter. It was written on official bank stationery, and handwritten, of course, you know. And there was one line in there that caught his ear, you know, when they read the line to him. And that was that his funds deposited in the bank were being most improperly employed. And he was shocked that his money in the Bank of England was being most improperly employed. He didn't know quite what that meant, but he knew that it was bad, that he wasn't doing something that he was supposed to do. And being a religious man, having never broken any laws, having never been arrested, his money being most improperly employed was shocking. And that was the bad news. The good news was that he had £235,000 on deposit in the bank. Now, in 14 years, this guy had gone from 1 year's savings to £235,000. He had gone from being the head deacon at St. James until now. He was a very wealthy businessman, and he had £235,000. Now, that's quite a bit of change. If you stop and think about it, a pound used to be compared to the American dollar. Back in those days, it would have been a pound was $5 and a dollar was a dollar. Well, of course, in 1754, we had these continental currencies, and they were about as valueless as our Federal Reserve notes today. But the general rule was a dollar was equal to about 20 cents of a British pound. Now, back in those days, you know, going back to about 1750 to 1800, you know, our money was worth a little more than it is today. It would buy more. It had more purchasing power. So, you know, if you adjusted that for inflation, you know, at 5 to 1, and then adjusted that for inflation. First of all, his £235,000 was worth $1 million, and if you valued $1 million in today's dollars compared to what it was in 1930 or 1850, it would have been 10 times that. In 1950, it was worth 10 times that. If you take a look at your dollar today, it took 10 cents to buy what a dollar does today. You know, gasoline's $2.65 a gallon, and in 1950, it was about 25 or 30 cents. You know, about 10 times less. So, it was worth 10 times more. This guy had $10 million, you know, in today's dollars. This guy had $10 million in the bank. pretty heady sum, and it's being most improperly employed. And that disturbed old John. And so, in the letter, it said, "It is of the utmost urgency that you come into the bank to discuss this matter." Not only was his money improperly employed, which he didn't quite understand what that meant, but it is of the utmost urgency that you come into the bank and discuss this matter. He was just dumbfounded. He was shocked. He went home. He was despondent. After he'd had the letter read to him, told his wife what had happened. She said, "Now calm down, John. John, you haven't broken any laws. You haven't done anything that's wrong. You've saved your money. You've been thrifty. You've deposited it in the bank, and the bank holds your money for you. And I'm sure that it will work out right." And so they prayed about it. You know, religious people, you know, they get nervous and excited, you know, and so they pray. And he prayed. And so he went into the bank with the letter, and he gave the letter to one of the people in the bank, who took him over to a bank officer who was very cordial and invited him to sit down, gave him a cigar, and complimented him and told him what a marvelous businessman he was and what a marvelous job he'd done with his tobacco business, and that he had £235,000 on deposit in the bank. And so the banker asked him why he had not invested his money in bonds or stocks or business ventures and one thing and another. And so John said, "Well, you know, I'm a tobacconist, and I don't know anything about stocks, and I don't know anything about bonds, and I don't know anything about other business ventures. All I know is tobacco, and I'm a good tobacconist. I can blend tobaccos, and I'm really good at what I do. And so that's why my customers keep coming back, and that's why I keep opening tobacco stores, and I keep training people in the art of blending tobaccos, and that's why we're so popular, and that's why we do so well, and that's why we're doing what we do." And so he listened to the banker as the banker explained to him how he was only getting 2% interest, and that if he were to invest his money, or if he would turn his money over to the bank would invest his money for him, and he could get into insurance, and he could get into other business ventures, which would pay him 5% or 10% return on his money. And if he wanted safer investments, the bank had safer investments. If he wanted riskier investments, they had riskier investments that paid more. And that they would assist him in every way possible and in a modality to more properly employ his money. So the banker handed him a brochure and said, "Here, read this and see what you think of this." Well, old John, you know, he took the brochure, he looked at it, and he kind of pretended like he was reading it, and the banker said, "Well, what do you think of that?" And he said, "Well, I don't know what to think of it." So the banker handed him another brochure, and he said, "Well, tell me what you think of this." And so old John, he looked at it, and he didn't know quite what he was looking at, and so the banker said, "Well, what do you think of that?" And old John didn't know quite what to think of it, and so he said, "Well, I don't know." And after some time, he looked at four or five of these brochures, he looked at four or five of these proposals, and the banker said, "Well, read it. Just read it, man. Just read it." So old Johnny is really feeling self-conscious now, and so he's looking down, and he's kind of fidgeting in his chair, and he looks over at the banker, and he says, "I can't read it." And the banker was shocked. Now, the banker was just absolutely incredulous. He said, "Sir?" And then John said, I can't read, and I can't write, and I can't read these brochures, and I don't know what they say." The banker, just shocked, speechless, said, "You mean You have 235,000 pounds in the bank? John said, yes. You have 14 tobacco stores? John said, yes. He said, my God, man, do you realize where you would be today if you could read and write? And old John Mallory looked at the banker and said, yes, sir. Yes, sir. If I could read and write, I would be the head deacon of St. James. Now, surely there's got to be a moral to that story, and I think Bill Gates kind of in our modern era is a shining example of a young man who, when he was in college, quit college, didn't get a degree, went out into the business world, opened a company, and the last time I'd heard, he had $35 billion. My God, Mr. Gates, can you imagine where you would be today if you had gotten a college degree? Now, you know, along that line, it reminded me of a story of my Uncle Lyle. My old Uncle Lyle, born in 1899. Great old guy. And one day he told me a story about how to hire yourself a job. Yeah, that's right. How to hire yourself a job. You see, my Uncle Lyle, born in 1899, by the time the Depression came about, 1929 through 37, was a young man in his 30s. And it was a time when, in America, the unemployment rate was about 25 to 30%. Depending upon where you were in the country, it could be even higher than that. But the nationwide unemployment rate, I think, was pretty much right at, they keep telling me, it's about 25%. And my Uncle Lyle was born in California, up on the north coast of California, in Westport, California. And as time progressed along, he worked in the woods, he worked in the mills, he was a lumberjack, he was a logger. He was good at his work, but in 1929, when the Great Depression broke out, 1930, 31, 32, so on, there was less and less demand for construction, less and less demand for lumber, and more people unemployed, and fewer mills producing, and more mills closing their doors. But there was one big mill in Scotia, California, called the Pacific Lumber Company. Pacific Lumber Company. Last time I heard, it was still the biggest redwood mill in the world, not the biggest lumber company necessarily, but in the redwood region of Northern California and Southern Oregon, it's a redwood mill. That's all they cut there is redwood. Well, pretty much. You know, there's other species they cut there, but primarily that was a redwood mill. Very well known. Sent their products all over the world. And my uncle Lyle came up to Scotia to get a job because it was the biggest mill, and they had about 600 employees. And it was rumored that every day about three employees either retired, died, got killed, or for some reason were terminated, and they were hiring three people a day. And, of course, in a mill that has 10 employees, your chances of getting a job there aren't nearly as good as a mill that's got 600 employees and three a day are quitting or leaving their jobs or doing something. They're changing three people a day in the staff, and there's 600 people. There's a big mill. The whole town of Scotia, you know, with all the houses that are there, and Riadel and next door to it, you know, all the people live there. They work there at that Scotia mill. So he went up to Scotia. He's unemployed now, you know. He goes up to Scotia, and when he got to the employment office, he said to me, when he described the scene, he said there was a line of men lined up, and he said there was about 100 men lined up to get in to put in their application for a job. So he looked at that long line of men standing out there, and he walked up to a guy, and he said, "How long has this line been here?" And he said, "This line is like this every day. Every day there's 100 men lined up. Sometimes people sleep here all night so that they can get to the head of the line so that they can put in their application." Now, you think about this. If 3 people a day are quitting, times, and let's just take 300 days in the year the mill is working, 6 days a week, you know, and then that's 900 positions a year that are being turned over. 3 people a day times 300 days, that's 900 positions, but the same 300 days times 100 people means that there's 30,000 people, 30,000 applications for 900 jobs. Boy, that's really depressing. And my Uncle Lyle thought about that for a minute, and he said, "You know, that means that out of 100 people standing here today putting in their applications, 3 of them are going to get a job and 97 of them are going to be disappointed. Tomorrow, 3 people are going to be hired, 97 people are going to be disappointed." So, you know, my Uncle Lyle, being a whiz kid, he could do his arithmetic. I mean, my Uncle Lyle's pretty smart. He could count with his shoes on and both hands in his pocket. And he could see that that wasn't a very good way to get a job. He could see that the odds were way, way higher than the probability of getting hired if he just went the conventional route, stood in line, waited his turn, filled out a job application. I mean, you know, there's lots of guys that are just as skilled, just as good a logger or lumberjack as my Uncle Lyle. Now, my Uncle Lyle was good. And he told me, he said, "You know, companies and employers, they keep the best men. They try to hire the best men, but you don't always hire the best man. But after he's worked there for a while, the boss can see who the best men are in the crew. And so there was always great competition among the workers in the crew to be the highest producing man in the crew. The guy that could set more chokers on more logs in a day. A guy who could turn out a bigger turn behind the cat than the other choker setters. The cat skinner, who could put more turns on the landing. The green chain puller, who could put more units together than any other green chain man." In other words, it used to be, in America, Americans used to work. The old adage that says that white men or white boys can't play basketball wasn't always true in this country. White men actually could work in America. And my Uncle Lyle was one of them. And that man, he could work. Now, today, that's no longer true. Americans can't work. They just can't do that. You know, before the Mexicans came in here, you know, we whites, you know, we used to buck bales of hay, you know, cut broccoli and spinach and lettuce. All the work, you know, that these foreigners and aliens do, we used to do here in America. Believe it or not. And then we got to going to college, you know, and then we got to thinking that, well, work is beneath us, and so we quit working, and so that's that story. Well, anyway, my Uncle Lyle, he devised a plan. So he didn't get in line. He just walked out into the yard, and he said to a guy out in the yard there, he said, "Who's the boss here?" And the guy said, "Well, it's Ben Johnson." And he said, "Well, where is Ben Johnson?" And he said, "He's over there." So my Uncle Lyle went over to the boss, Ben Johnson. And as it turned out, Ben Johnson had a crew of 14 men working in the yard. And they were called yard men. And these men in the yard would sticker lumber so it would dry. They didn't have dry kilns in the old days. And so they would take a unit of lumber after it came off the green chain, let's say 2x10s, and they'd bring it out and they'd set it on a pair of blocks. And then a guy would take 5 boards and lay them on another pair of blocks right next to it. And then he would put 5 one-inch sticks in between it, and then he put five more boards on top of that was so that they could get air between the boards. These boards had to be air-dried. They had to be dried, and so they were air-dried, and so these were yard men. So. And so my Uncle Lyle goes up to the boss, and he said to him, he said, "They sent me out from the office, and they told me that you needed a yard man. And here I am, ready to go to work." And the boss, Ben Johnson, who already had a full crew of 14, said, "I didn't ask for anybody to be sent out." And he said, "Are you Ben Johnson?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you're the man." And they sent me out, and they said, "You look for Ben Johnson, and they want me out here working for you." Well, the boss was kind of surprised, and he said, "Well, okay." And so he said, "Well, there's a pile of lumber over there that's fallen over." And he said, "I want you to take that pile of lumber over there that's fallen over, and I want you to straighten it out and restack it on that pair of blocks sitting next to it." So my Uncle Lyle went over there, and he went to work on that pile of lumber. And there's 3,000 board feet in a pile. And he stacked it in about 35 minutes, which is pretty good. Normally it takes about an hour. He did it in 35 minutes. And with that, I'm going to take a break right here and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives. That can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're telling you a couple of stories here. This is story time on the Law Hour and editorial review. Well, my Uncle Lyle now stacked a pile of lumber, about 3,000 board feet, did it in 35 minutes. The purpose for going out here and stacking this pile of lumber is to demonstrate his skill, ability, and his dedication to hard work. Ben Johnson, of course, the boss, is duly impressed. And so he had my Uncle Lyle take the pile of boards that he had just stacked. And he said to him, "Stack it back on the same two blocks in the same position as it was before it fell over." So my Uncle Lyle hopped to it, and he restacked the pile of boards that he had just stacked and restacked it to where it had originally fallen over. And he said he did that in about 35 minutes also. comes over to the boss. He says, I'm finished. What do you want me to do next? The boss says, restack the pile of lumber that you just stacked back to where you had just removed it from on the blocks next to it. My Uncle Lyle says, aye, aye, Captain, and he restacked the pile of lumber. Came over to the boss. He says, okay, I'm finished. What do you want me to do next? He says, restack it where it came from. And so my Uncle Lyle went over and restacked, and each time he restacks it, he is working harder and against himself to see if he can do it in less time. He actually got it down to 25 minutes. He could restack a pile of lumber. That is 3,000 board feet in 25 minutes. Some 26, 27, 28. He restacked the pile of lumber approximately two times an hour for 12 hours. In those days, they worked 12-hour days. Not eight. It was 12 hours. And then he restacked the pile of lumber from one set of blocks to the other set of blocks. That's all he did all day long, was to stack that one 3,000-foot unit of lumber. He stacked it on the blocks to the left, and then he stacked them to the right, and then he stacked them to the left, and he stacked them to the right, and he stacked them to the left, and he stacked them to the right. And I said to my Uncle Lyle, I said, well, if they made me do that, I'd quit. And then my Uncle Lyle said, why? And I said, because that's stupid. That's why. And my Uncle Lyle said, what's stupid about it? And I said, stacking the same pile of lumber on the blocks to the left and blocks to the right and blocks to the left and blocks to the right is stupid because it doesn't accomplish anything. And my Uncle Lyle said, does it pay any less? And then I said, well, I don't know. And he said, it doesn't. He said, boy, when you go to work for a man, he's buying your time. And you're selling the man your time. What business is it of yours? What the buyer of your time wants to do with the time that he buys from you. After all, it's his time, it's his property. Can't he do with it as he pleases, even if it's foolish? Now, boys and girls, I'm about 14 years old. And I thought about that for a minute, and I said, oh, I didn't know that. When a man buys my time, I'm selling him my time, and my time becomes his property. Doesn't the man who is buying my time, purchasing my property, and I'm selling him my property, and he's paying me money, doesn't he have a right to utilize my time in any way that he sees fit, even if, in my opinion, he's wasting my time, and what he has me doing is stupid? Now, for a 14-year-old kid, that's a pretty valuable lesson to learn in life. And I learned it. So I asked my Uncle Lyle, I said, Now, they actually didn't hire you. And you went out here and you worked the whole day stacking this lumber back and forth in the same piles. And my Uncle Lyle said, yeah, Ben Johnson was just testing me. He was just watching me. He just wanted to see what kind of a worker I was. He just wanted to see if I'd tell him to take this job and shove it. And I didn't. And I shut up. And I did what I was told. And I did it faster than anybody else. And I did it better than anybody else. I demonstrated in my first day on the job that I was the best and that I was the fastest and that I was the most industrious worker that he had on his crew, so that he would want to keep me. He did. And I kept working there until payday. Now, in those days, they paid every 2 weeks, and they paid in cash. And pay with checks back in the 30s. They paid in cash. And they paid you with an envelope. So you walked up to the paymaster, they called him, and the paymaster would have an envelope. And they had them in alphabetical order. And so you walked in to the paymaster on Saturday night. You worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. So after work on Saturday, you would, at 6 o'clock on Saturday, they started 6 in the morning and worked till 6 at night. You got over and got in line, you walked into your paymaster, at more than one, they walked into your paymaster, and he would have your pay envelope there. So my Uncle Lyle got in line just like everybody else, and he walked up to the line and he said, "Stanley Lyle." And the guy goes flipping through the envelopes, and he gets to the S's, and he's looking for Stanley Lyle, and there's no pay envelope. And he said, "Where do you work?" And he said, "I work for Ben Johnson. I'm a yard man." And so he looks again, and he says, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry, but there's no pay envelope in here. You'd better tell your boss that your pay envelope wasn't in here and have him come into the office. Something's not right here, and I don't know what it is." So my Uncle Lyle, on Monday, bides his time, and then he says to Ben Johnson, kind of casually, you know, he says, "Now, I went over to get my pay, walked up to the paymaster, and they didn't have my pay envelope there." He said he didn't know what was wrong, but that I should report to you and tell you that there's something wrong, and to ask you if you would go over to the office and straighten that out for me. And Ben Johnson said to my Uncle Lyle, "You bet I will, Lyle. I'll take care of that today. You can rest assured you're going to get paid, Lyle." So Ben Johnson comes out to him an hour or two later, and he says, Lyle, something's wrong. We don't know what happened, but they don't have any record of your employment here. Something has happened. They must have lost your employment application, and all of your paperwork is gone. So I told them that I would send you right over to fill out the paperwork so that you can get paid." So my Uncle Lyle went right over to the office. Now remember, there's 100 men standing out here in line waiting to fill out their paperwork. My Uncle Lyle goes right up to the head of the line, walks into the office. And he says, "I'm Lyle Stanley. I'm a yard man, and I'm working over here in the yard for Ben Johnson. And he sent me over here to fill out some paperwork." And someone in the office says, "Right over here, Mr. Stanley. I have it ready for you." My Uncle Lyle filled out the paperwork and went back to work. My Uncle Lyle hired himself a job. And that's the moral to the story. You see, an employer really isn't interested too much in your resume or who you are. He's really interested in what can you do and how much money, how much profit can you make for this enterprise? How valuable are you to the overall goals of this business, which is to make money? The only purpose for business, boys and girls, is to make a profit. If you thought that the business was there to employ people or to make certain products or to clean up the environment, Oh, no, you got that wrong. The only purpose for business, the primary purpose for business, the real purpose for business, is organized to make profit. If they happen to make a useful product, if they happen to employ somebody, if they happen to clean up the environment as a side benefit in the due course of making profit, that may well benefit you. It may well benefit society, or it may well benefit the ecology. But that's not why the business was established, and that's not why it exists. So understand another very vitally important rule of business. Business exists to make profit, and without profit, business ceases to exist. bottom line. Well, some years later, I was working for the Earl Sherman Company in Oakland, California, and one day a guy came back from the Vietnam War, and he'd been in Vietnam for a couple of years, and I guess I'd taken his place, and when he came back, the union rule said that the veteran gets priority. I don't know what happened to that rule now. I understand all these veterans, they leave, they go to war, they come back, and they're unemployed. Well, it didn't used to be that way in this country. It used to be when a man went into the military, and he came back, the landlubbers, the guys that didn't go off to war, lost their jobs for the veteran. And that's the way it was with me, so I lost my job to the veteran. Okay, now I'm unemployed. And so we're driving home. And Phil Della Riva, who is riding in the carpool with me, was lamenting the fact that I had lost my job. And he said, I don't know what I would do if I was laid off. I don't know what I would do if I lost my job. Two other guys in the car, and they were lamenting also that, oh my God, I don't know what I would do if I lost my job. So I said, as we were crossing the Park Street Bridge, I said, boys, I was looking for a job when I found that one. And I said, you know, I've always wanted to work in a shipyard. And I said, as we crossed the Park Street Bridge from Oakland into Alameda, I said, turn right here and drop me off at Pacific Coast Engineering. It was not the biggest shipyard in Alameda. Todd Shipyards was the big one. They employed around 9 to 12,000 people all the time. But Pacific Coast Engineering was, you know, pretty good size for a shipyard. You know, it's a shipyard. And after all, I didn't know much about ships and shipbuilding and one thing and another. I was a certified welder, but I wasn't a boiler maker, and I wasn't an iron worker, and I kind of wanted to get into something that was big, heavy duty. And so they dropped me off right in front of the gate. And as I opened the door to the car, I picked up my lunch bucket, and I looked over, and there was a guard check. I picked up my lunch bucket, and I took off on a dead run. And when I got to the guard shack, the guard said, you better hurry, you're late. And I said, you can say that again. And so I ducked into a building. It was Building 8. Now, you don't just walk into a shipyard, and you don't just walk in, you know, unannounced. You have to have a card. And it just so happens that Pacific Coast Engineering did some government work, and that government work, some of it's secret, and you're not supposed to have... You have to have a security clearance to get into Building A. Now, I'm in Building A, and I don't have a security clearance. I don't work here. So I looked around, and I saw this humongous building. I'd never seen anything this big before in my life. It must have been a quarter of a mile long, and it terminated down here like a tunnel, you know, just light at the end. And there was a ship out there at the end, sir. It was a Coast Guard cutter. There was a 300-foot Coast Guard cutter that Pacific Coast Engineering had just completed in there. So anyway, there's all these people running around, you know, all this beehive activity going around. So I looked over and I saw locker room, so I went into the locker room, and I put my lunch bucket up on top of the lockers. Didn't have any other place to put it. And then I walked out and I saw this guy, and I said, who's the foreman here? And he said, well, that's Jim Edwards. And so I said, Jim Edwards? Where is he? And he said, well, he's down on that ship down at the end of the building. And so I said, well, okay. So I had to look like I was doing something, and I saw a piece of angle iron down there, so I picked up the piece of angle iron, and I started walking with it. And I took the piece of angle iron, and I carried it down about a quarter of a mile to the end of the building, and I got down to the end of the building, and I got to the gangplank, and then there was a guard there at the gangplank. And I said to the guard, I said, I'm looking for Jim Edwards. You know where I'm going to find him? And the guy said, no, I don't know any Edwards. He said, go on up on deck and start asking around up there. So I did. I carried my angle iron up to the top of the gangplank, and I was on the deck, and I saw a guy there, and I said, I'm looking for Jim Edwards. And he said, Edward, so I think he's down there with the engineers down in the bilge. Now, boys and girls, I didn't know what a bilge was from the mast, so I said, could you point me to the ladder I need to get on? And so he pointed over there and he said, take that ladder down and you'll go down about three decks and they'll be down in the bilge. I said, okay. So I got on the ladder and I went down, 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 and I got down to the bottom. And there was a bunch of guys there, and I could tell they were important because they all had hard hats on and they were all wearing neckties. I could tell that these guys were really different than the other guys packing iron around on this ship. And so I got down here to the bilge. Now the bilge, that's down in the bottom of the boat where there's water and oil and all kinds of bad, nasty stuff. And these guys are standing around there looking at some papers down there called plans. And so I stood there, and I didn't say anything. And as I stood there with my piece of iron, pretty soon some guy looks over at me and he says, can I help you? And I said, I'm looking for Jim Edwards. And another guy said, I'm Edwards, what do you want? And I said, they sent me out from the office to go to work. And he said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a welder. And he said, hell, I don't need any welders, I need fitters. And I said, well, that's all right, I'm a fitter, and I can fit. And he said, will you work swing? I said, hell, I'll work swing, graveyard, I don't care. And he said, well, listen, I need about five fitters. Listen, if you can fit, I'm tied up here right now. He said, you come back tomorrow night at 4:30. Come in a little early. Come in at 4. And I'll show you what I want you to do. And I said, listen, write that down for me, would you? So that I'll know where to go. And he whipped out a little piece of paper and he wrote Building A. And then he put his name on it and he said, what's your name? And I said, George Gordon. And so he put George Gordon, meet me at 4 o'clock in my office, Building A. So the next day, the next night I showed up, you know, about 4 o'clock. Now you got a little problem here. You can't just walk in here unless you got clearance. And so I said, well, I'll tell you what. Give me the instructions. And then make sure you put on there that you want a fitter. And then make sure that you write on there a specialty, would you? And he said, are you a specialist? And I said, yeah, I'm a heliarc welder. And if you'd put on there specialty, then I think that'll help me. And he said, well, all right. So he put specialty on there. And that morning at 8 o'clock, I went into the office and I said, I'm a specialist. I'm a heliarc welder. And they need me as a fitter in Building A. And the guy that needs me over there, he's given me this note here and wants me to bring it in to you. And I did. Jim Edwards. Now, the Todd Shipyard just laid off 6,000 people over here. And there were boilermakers everywhere looking for work. And so I said, well, you got to have a clearance and you got to have union membership. So I went down to the union and I showed them that I was hiring on as a specialist. That moved me to the head of the line. And I got my union membership. And then I had to go down to the Coast Guard and get a clearance. I had to get a security clearance. And I went down and made my application for security clearance. And I could pass that. Now, they don't give you that the same day you go down there, but they give you a piece of paper. And so I took it back to the office, and by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was hired on as a specialist, a heliarc welder. And I took my papers over to the boss, and he looked them all over, and he said, well, you're a heliarc welder. Hell, I don't need a heliarc welder, and I don't need a specialist. What I need is somebody that can fit. And I said, well, just in case anything comes up with aluminum, remember, I'm the guy that can weld it. And he said, okay, now here's where you got to go. And so he took me over, and they were building a mine locomotive for Peru. Oh, no, it was Bolivia. A tin mine locomotive for Bolivia. They're building a big crane over there that was going down over the Panama Canal, too. But so I got over here, and here's this mine locomotive, and they had a desk over there with the blueprints on it, and there must have been about 30 pages, and I'd say those pages were probably about 3 by 6 feet long, and they had an index over there, and that's what a fitter does. He goes over and he reads those blueprints, and then he takes the pieces that are marked. You know, they'll say 1A and 16B and 37T, and I mean, they got hundreds of parts, you know, that are going into this thing over here, and now, remember, boys and girls, I'm a welder, but I'm not a fitter. I've never been in a shipyard in my life. So they had a fellow over there that's called the lead man. And I walked over to the lead man and I said, hey, I'm a new hire. And I really don't know my, you know, hind end from a hot rock. But I'll tell you what, I'll light your cigarettes and I'll pour your coffee. And I'll be your N-word man, and what do you want me to do? Now, everybody likes to have one of these N-word men, see, that'll pour his coffee and light his cigarettes. And so he said, you know, you're going to get along all right here, Gordon. And so I followed him around, you know, like a little puppy dog, and then he took me over and he showed me the index. That's a book about, you know, 200 pages. And that just tells you what blueprint to go to find that piece and show you where to fit it up. And in about a week's time, I had just about mastered the fitting trade. It took me just about a week. And then I started fitting things together. And I didn't have any problem fitting things together, and that worked out pretty well. Until one day, the Earl Sherman Company called me back to work about a month or so later, and they said they had another opening. And it just so happened that the Sherman Company, building fire engines, was paying better than the boilermakers were making in the shipyards. And so I announced to my boss that I was going to leave and go back to where I'd come. And he said, no, no, you are the best fitter that I've got on my crew in 30 days. Used to be an old adage, you know, in the trades, that if you couldn't master the job in a week, you were in the wrong line of work. When I went to work in the woods, I had 5 days to learn how to be a choker setter. When I wanted to load trucks, I had 5 days to learn how to load trucks. When I wanted to run cat, I had 5 days to learn how to run cat. If you couldn't master it, if you couldn't catch on to what needed to be done, you were in the wrong line of work. Boys and girls, Americans used to be able to work, and Americans used to be able to hire themselves a job. And it isn't any different today. The guy that hires you wants somebody that's going to make him money. And if you're that man, there isn't any reason why you can't hire yourself a job. Well, all right, boys and girls, we're out of time again. I'm going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review, and we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Remember, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. We're open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.